and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values, the people behind the positions that are shaping our common life, and how we can build more understanding and empathy across our very many differences. Every episode, I try and do a deep dive with someone who has some kind of public voice or public position. I'm trying to understand the principles that are driving them to get a handle on their worldview, really. My theory is that in the age of tighter and tighter filter bubbles, listening to a range of voices from wildly different tribes and perspectives is important for us to grow as citizens, and frankly, just to grow up as people. Before that sounds too earnest, I should also say, as well as it being a good and important thing to do, it seems to make the world just a lot more interesting. In this episode, I spoke to Anaya Folari Iman. Anaya has been a host on GB News, which is a television channel in the UK, a candidate for the Brexit Party. She's written for Spiked Online, and she is now the founder of the Equiano Project, which describes itself as a debate, discussion, and ideas forum that focuses on race, culture, and politics. We spoke about her childhood as the daughter of a Nigerian immigrant single mum who was unusually an atheist, about coming to different conclusions to her student friends at university about race and why she thinks people really need a sense of agency. I hope you enjoy listening. Anaya, it is a really big question to start someone off with. It's not a very good warm-up question. What is sacred to you? So maybe I'll give you just a minute to get your brain into it by asking, how did you feel about the word? Did it feel comfortable and attractive or unusual, spiky? What was your reaction to it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm quite warm to that word. You know, I actually wish that it was talked about more in public life, but I think oftentimes, anytime someone talks about the notion of the sacred or what is sacred, I think oftentimes people feel queasy, that they might think it's a bit hippie, a bit new age, or from a time that is no longer rational and reasoned. And so in public life, I think it's not one that I hear often, but I wish it wasn't that way. So when I got that question, when the word sacred was presented to me, I was really excited. I was surprised and excited.
Good. And having had a bit of time to sit with it, this very big question about what's sacred to you, what bubbled up?
Yeah, so it took me a while to think about it for the reasons that I just alluded to. And what I thought was sacred to me was the notion of home. And I think that's different to just family. Like, home to me, a place of security, stability, a foundation, a place that you put roots down, a place that you go back to and feel a sense of recognition and familiarity with the objects and the way that it looks and the way that it smells. And that, to me, has increasingly become a very, very important idea for me. So I moved around a lot growing up. So I was born in London and born in Streatham in southwest London, and then moved to southeast London, and then moved to Kent, and then went to boarding school in Hertfordshire, and then went to university in Leeds. So I ended up going to six different schools, three primary schools and three secondary schools. And I came from a broken home. And so home to me has increasingly meant all of the things that were fractured and unattainable for me for much of my youth. And it's only something that I've realized because I was so used to that, not having a secure, rooted sense of home and place. I forged a sense of self that was all about independence and traveling and you know, creating your own identity and reinventing the wheel and creating your own values. And so I was quite resistant and suspicious of people that had the same friends their whole life and never left their home and community. But I think as I've passed my, as I'm in my mid-20s, somewhat past my mid-20s, I've realised actually the relationships, the meaning, the rootedness, the sense of satisfaction and stability and security that I've not had and wanted and now I'm very driven to attain. So home to me is something that I hold very dearly and see as sacred and intrinsic to lots of other aspects of my life and my sense of fulfillment and meaning.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Where is your home now? Where are you managing to put those roots down?
So it's still somewhat not decided. I would just say London is probably my home now. I was born there, as I mentioned. I've lived there since leaving university, and I think it's a place that I'm going to live for a long time. So there's something what I like about London, and it's got its criticisms and it's got its cliches, but there is something still very true about its diversity, its multiculturalism. It's both transient but also consistent in the fact that there are people that have lived here their whole life, but people that have found home here. So for people that never really had that sense of place that was consistent, I think London is a great place to find that, because there's many other people in a similar boat to you that still call it home despite not having been here for a long time or being born in different parts of the world. And it has all of those things, whether that's the city to the suburbs, rich and poor and different, all different kind of social classes and cultural values. So I think that allows me to claim London as my home.
Amen, yes. I'm also a London lover. I'd love to hear more about the big ideas in your childhood. And it's so helpful that sense of transient has been formative kind of in different ways at different times in your life. But maybe we could just start with your mum. You said this beautiful thing about a home will always partly be where your mother lives, which made me a bit teary. Could you just paint a little, could you tell us a little bit about her story?
Yeah, so my mum is... So she went to school in the UK, but she was born in Nigeria, and then went to university in Nigeria, then kind of came back in her early 20s. And it's interesting, she, similar on that kind of home theme, her mother was not the first wife, so it was part of a polygamous household. And so again, home... in the context of many of generations before mine was not a traditional construct as we kind of generally understand it. And then she left, you know, her home to come to the UK practically on her own. And, you know, she had my sister, then she had me, and she did it almost exclusively by herself. And she was someone that was raised in quite a middle-class Nigerian household. But what is a familiar story to many children of immigrants or immigrants themselves is that when you come to often a Western society, you know, Britain, you often start at the bottom of society. You know, you have to work your way up and are faced with a whole new set of challenges, whether that's immigration status, certain values and ideals. And this was something that she, you know, had to negotiate very much by herself. And unlike many West African immigrants to the UK, what's quite unique about my mum is that she's an atheist. She's not actually a kind of evangelical Christian or a Muslim, which is the overwhelming majority of Nigerian people are. So she's someone that you know, raised two children on her own, you know, was an immigrant to the UK, but had very strong values from Nigeria and thought for herself, and didn't necessarily believe some of the ideals and values in the society that she lived in. So that she's always been a very independent minded, very strong willed and passionate woman.
Do you mind me asking, do you know, had she inherited, had she been brought up in a faith that she then rejected? And if so, not why? Or had she been brought up not religious?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting one with Nigeria, because of late it has been associated with various religious conflicts, particularly in the north of Nigeria around radical Islam. But actually, Christians and Muslims have lived very well together in Nigeria for several decades, and if not hundreds of years. And the family on my mother's side, some of them were Muslim, some of them were Christian, and it was all a kind of a bit of a mix of faiths, to be honest. So she was broadly raised as a Christian, but there were influences of other religious practices and ideas mixed in there as well, and so it was always quite loose. But she ultimately came to reject it, you know, when I was younger.
Do you remember it?
I do remember it. So it was the household that I grew up in was British Nigerian. So as I was raised also in Kent, that it was a majority white British kind of environment in schools and so on. But many of the friends that my mother had made were people that had a similar story to her, which were immigrants from Nigeria. So the majority of them were evangelical Christians. And I think the reason that she rejected it, there was a small point when I was younger where she really did try and adopt all of the attitudes, the beliefs that are associated with kind of Pentecostal Christians. But this was at a particular time in her life where she was going through economic challenges and issues around migration status, that she ultimately felt that that what she was doing, that it wasn't working, that the prayer and the all of the things, you know, going to church and, you know, giving tithe, and the people around were not actually improving her life. And so she left because she felt that it wasn't giving the things that she felt that it promised.
And were there other big ideas around in your childhood? Was there a kind of political sensibility either from her or that you developed early?
Yeah, so I think a conservatism has always run through my family, and it is very interesting. You know, when we hear in political and social discourse a particular attitude that you know, the ethnic minority people are only really from one particular political camp, but conservatism as a philosophy what was very strong in my family and my upbringing. And it wasn't a kind of systematic kind of political philosophy, you know, in terms of reading the thinkers and so on, but it was just a kind of general orientation, a general outlook. And that sense of personal responsibility, that's one. And I think that is true for a lot of immigrant families, not least because it takes a lot of get up and go and personal responsibility to leave the community and family that you are raised in, that you've only known, to start out a life in another country and try and do everything you can to give your children the best opportunities. There's something about that sense of hardworking, go-getting, immigrant optimism, as Tony Saul describes it. So that kind of sense of personal responsibility, hard work, a very strong focus, a very strong sense of discipline, a strong educational ethos, and general traditional values. Responsibility, family, duty, mutual obligation. These things that have, I think, increasingly been disregarded or marginalized. There's values that are no longer fashionable or representative of a modern cosmopolitan woman or modern cosmopolitan person, are things that were a given, are a given to me and continue to be. And that, I think, was very influential for the Nigerian aspect of my upbringing, the kind of strong figures in my life, like my mother and my grandmother and my aunties and uncles. Yeah. So I would say a kind of general conservative outlook has always been an undercurrent of my thinking and broader positioning.
What were you, let's take a little snapshot. Imagine yourself now, age 13. I'd love to just get a sense of what you were like. What three words might your friends have used to describe you, age 13?
Oh God, that's tough. I think passionate. I was very surprised. I mean, this is a bit younger, but I was very surprised to see a video of me when I think it was my fifth birthday, and I had lots of my school friends from primary school around, and there was that we were all doing karaoke, and I was very surprised to find that on many occasions I attempted to take the mic off of other people when it was their turn and said, I want to speak. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, this, I have not changed for 20 years. So I think one of the words I've always been very passionate very strong-minded, open and curious, but also, had a sense of conviction and was unafraid to express myself. So that's one. I think curious as well. And a very strange thing for someone in their preteens. I grew up on a program called The Big Questions, and I was very sad when they stopped the show. It was a Sunday religious and ethics and politics show on the BBC, and I would wake up every Sunday to watch these shows about religion and ideas and these big debates. And I've always been so curious about the way that different people think, and that's one of the reasons why I studied Arabic and politics, and I've always studied languages since I was very young. So a curiosity about the world. Not least, I went to a state school, I went to a private school, I went to a grammar school, I went to different schools. And so I was always very interested in how different social values and attitudes create different conditions for different types of people. So passionate, curious.
Have you always been, you're someone who feels really, comes across as very comfortable with debate. Have you always find that kind of argumentation energizing rather than threatening, which some people do?
I find it so exciting, so interesting that that we all, I mean, it's a truism, but the fact that we all have our own mind and think differently, and all of our experiences inform our perspective and how we negotiate those differences in a society that kind of prides itself on being liberal and open. And so to me, debate has always been intrinsic to negotiating differences and kind of building some kind of consensus, not least because the alternative is kind of imposition. And when we do that, that obviously has its other unintended consequences. But on top of that, you know, living in a society like Britain, who has such a rich and fascinating past and has positioned itself historically and continues to do in many ways as this kind of beacon of particular ideals and trying to shape the world and move the world forward. It has had to engage with and draw upon cultures and religious attitudes and values from across the world. And that's always that, and being able to pull onto that and bring that together and inform a much more interesting and deeper and culturally exciting society to me is just seems so obvious that that's what we should do. And so to debate, I've always found it very exhilarating, and I've never felt that there was any subject that, whether that is race or being a woman or whatever that might be, that I've found as off limits. Yeah. And on top of that, you know, even if in the mainstream that some people are not wanting to debate something, it will be debated in some form or another. So I'd prefer it to be out in the open.
Yeah. One last question kind of about your childhood, and I want to ask it carefully, partly because I think it can get a bit boring for people of colour to be asked this, but it's important because of what we'll talk about shortly in terms of race and identity. How much was your identity as someone with Nigerian heritage important to you, central to your sense of self, and did it cause problems? Did you experience prejudice or racism as you were growing up?
So it's really difficult. You know, these things are always difficult to think about and discuss when you get older. Because, and so I will answer your question more directly, but I think understanding what goes on amongst what children who are influenced by so many different things, understanding that as racism, to me is a very difficult, it's kind of difficult to understand those things as racism. Because to me, you know, I understand racism as when it's discrimination and prejudice against people of real or perceived different races, but not just that. On top of that, when that's given kind of moral and cultural authority by institutions, so people can say something or be prejudiced or what have you. That we all have the capacity to do that. But to me, you know, racism, as something that kind of organizes society, is much more about power and institutions. And so, to think about when people ask me about whether or not I've experienced racism as a child, I think it's very difficult to think of childhood experiences in that way, because I think it's a very adult political question. But did I experience people picking on me because they of my skin color? Yes. Was it something that was an everyday occurrence? Did it? No. That it wasn't. Was it something that affected me on a deep personal level? The answer is no. And in all honesty, I haven't experienced any direct in person prejudice for pretty much for like 5, 6, 7 years. I can count on both hands, you know, just about how many direct racist statements have been made to me about me. So in that sense, it wasn't something that was a very big experience or a big part of me growing up. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful for that. I count that lucky because other people say things quite different to me in that respect. But it wasn't something that was a big feature of my childhood, no.
Mm. And you've spoken a little bit about being at university and a kind of growing sense of your political philosophy emerging and finding that often at odds with other students of colour and the way they were thinking about their own identity and their emerging political philosophy. Could you just say a bit more about that?
Yeah, so, you know, as I've said, that just from very young, you know, I've been very curious about ideas. I've been very curious about debating and discussing all of the big issues that shape society politically and socially. And, you know, I was very excited to go to university and to do that in a much more academically and intellectually rigorous way. I mean, that's what I understood was the purpose of university, to train the next generation of leaders to think critically and to think out loud about issues that they will go on to have responsibility for in their respective fields and contribute new knowledge and new ideas to particular subjects. And I started university, I think, pretty much at the height of the kind of 2014 to 2020, the peak of the campus free speech culture wars. You know, just the year after my first year of university, we voted for Brexit. We had Trump. So it was a very tumultuous time politically. And actually, whilst I had a great time at university, I learned some amazing things and, you know, it defined me in many ways. What I was very sad about was the fact that when it came to many of these big debates in society around populism, around race and identity, there was one view that was promoted. There was one view that was legitimized as morally right and good, and that was not up for debate. And actually, there was a movement that was endorsed by my student union at the time called Why Is My Curriculum White? And as a curious, open young person who wants to hear about the kinds of ideas that are being championed by your university, I was very open to being convinced, of course. And, you know, attending many of those events, I would argue it promoted a very narrow, one-sided view of British society and its relationship with its kind of former colonial countries. So I often talk about a particular example of an event that I went to on so-called decolonizing gender. And it essentially argued that there was no sex difference or recognized gender difference in pre-colonial Africa. And that actually it was a kind of Western imperialist endeavor in order to organize people in particular societies around labor and reproduction. And to me, this was seemed purely conjecture. And what's one of the evidence that was presented was the fact that in the Yoruba language, that many terms are not gendered. So as you have with Spanish or French, there's a feminine and a masculine way of saying things. That for Yoruba, there isn't apparently the same thing. And that's a huge statement to make about pre-colonial social organization based off of that. And it became increasingly clear to me that people were working backwards from a preconceived idea that that Western society was intrinsically racist, misogynistic, and dominating, and that non-Western societies are essentially primarily kind of children and victims of and lack agency and are solely just the subject of this all-encompassing, dominating white Western force. And that was not the experiences that from my family. And it was one that I think robbed African people of their own perspectives, our own stories, our own relationships, our own histories of triumph, but also domination also. And so it was really through many of these experiences around undermining freedom of expression and free speech and decolonizing the curriculum and issues related to that, that really made me develop a much more intellectually rooted view of human agency, about human freedom and universalistic politics.
It must have been, this is pure conjecture, so feel free to push back, but it must have been, I imagine it was emotionally quite fraught as a person of colour to be coming to different conclusions than the kind of dominant intellectual temperature of the time. Did you lose friends? Did it feel difficult at times?
Oh, you know, I lost many friends, and you know, it was very interesting. You know, it was such a strange experience. You know, another example that I refer to often is I was editing a section of the student newspaper, and I wanted to commission an article on decolonizing the curriculum. Why is my curriculum white? I mean, you know, as a student, this is a particular movement that is shaping campus discussions. Surely we should want to ensure that we represent a range of different views. And when I tried to do that, I had a flood of emails from a minority of students, because this is not, I don't think this is representative of most students. I don't think most students care, to be honest, but that's a minority of students who accused me of platforming white supremacy and things of that nature. And, you know, it only emboldened me. You know, I said, you know, I'm going to host a free speech event on campus, and the university were, they tried to push back. They wanted the speakers to have a code of conduct signed form and all sorts of things. It ultimately did take place. And, you know, it just happens that I'm somebody that doesn't like to be censored. But it's sad when you start to think differently in a way that actually alienates you from people that you would have thought were the kinds of people that would be your great friends. And, you know, I think it is sad because we do live in a time where thinking politically or socially different to other people is often a deal breaker in terms of friendships and relationships. And I don't think it has to be that way. You know, I think I love the stories of, you know, during Christmas, the aunties and uncles around and, you know, the uncle saying, you know, the most cringeworthy things and someone else is saying something else. But at the end of the day, you all love each other. You're all a family. You know, it's fine. But I think we've increasingly lost that that sense that behind someone's kind of political views is a genuine person that is worthy of dignity and respect. But not just that, that actually people come to their political views for a whole host of reasons, and that they may know something or experience something that you haven't, that has informed their perspective. And, you know, we need to understand that. We need to discuss that. We need to talk about that. And so it is sad to me that, you know, for a lot of young people, and what I found was that was a deal breaker in terms of being a friend, my friend, but I don't think it should be that way at all.
And I'd love you to spell out, and perhaps you can do it by talking about the Equiano Project, which is this organization that you founded since graduating. Could you just summarize for kind of lay people like me what your position is on how we navigate differences like race in society, and what is it that you see, I'm not going to use the word problematic, challenging about some of the identitarian narratives?
Okay, now there's a few things. So one of the things is the question of progress. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of thinkers that have been writing critical things about the notion of progress. But I think in order to have a sensible discussion about racism in contemporary Britain, I think we have to have a much more realistic discussion about how far we've come. And I think we no longer, I think it should be obvious for many people that we no longer live in a society that is supportive and sanctioning of slavery and colonial impositions. I think that's a very important thing to recognise, even though it's quite obvious. But let's even take history much more recent. When I speak to people that I know of older generations that are now 60s, 70s and 80s, they talk about the fact that their parents were, you know, their parents would be horrified at the idea of them being with someone of a different ethnicity or even living next to someone of a different ethnicity. They can talk about experiences of having horrible things thrown through their windows and living under conditions of fear as recently as perhaps even the 80s. And we no longer, I think it's really important to recognise we no longer live in a society like that. Social attitude surveys in the UK have consistently demonstrated that racism in the form of not being okay with your child dating someone of a different race or living next to someone of a different race is in long-term decline. And on top of that, that people no longer think that Britishness must mean that you're white. And in 50 years, if that, less than that, we have fundamentally transformed when it comes to our attitude about different racial groups. So I think that is really important to, in my view, to contextualize the discussion about whether or not we should be kind of optimistic or pessimistic about how we treat each other when it comes to our attitudes to race. But I think one thing about the discussion in society is it seeks to downplay progress and often says that racism hasn't actually been in decline, that it's only transformed, that actually the problem now is more about unconscious bias or covert racism. And that's the real problem, this kind of psychological prejudice that we don't even know ourselves. And I think that that's really harmful when there are huge material and lived experience as evidence that racism has got much better when it comes to, you know, the proportion of people's attitudes. Secondly, on that same point, it's deeply pessimistic. So this idea that society is structurally racist or institutionally racist, and it doesn't even matter if individuals within that particular organisation or institution are racist themselves, but the society has attitudes or cultures that are just intrinsically racist, I think is deeply pessimistic. Because I think that for most people in society, we are all negotiating with one another, you know, treating people as best that we can, being kind and just trying to get on. And I think when you reimagine normal human relationships and the imperfections of society as being embedded in racism, I think that you kind of foster a sense of mutual distrust and resentment. And we see that in attitudes and around discussions about institutional racism in the police or healthcare. Actually, what often happens is that you then corrode people's trust in those institutions and therefore they're less likely to participate in them as citizens. So, for example, the way that ethnic minority people for a long time were more likely to be have levels of kind of vaccine skepticism, but also in the discussions around stop and search and policing. When you embed a particular narrative that our society is structured in a particular way against people by virtue of their race, then you foster a sense of suspicion and pessimism, which can actually disempower individuals from participating as equal citizens within society. So to me, recognising progress is a really important issue. Actually being much more optimistic and more trusting about our fellow citizen and how far we've come. And then the third thing for me is that how it essentializes ethnic minority people. Now we see in these discussions all the time, whether that's conservative political figures and others who perhaps have conservative views about immigration, but they happen to be ethnic minority people also, or Brexit, or these other issues, that somehow their authenticity as an ethnic minority person is delegitimized and questioned. And it is to suggest that actually to be an ethnic minority person is only a very specific thing. And to me, that is essentially repackaging old ideas, which argued that your racial identity said something about your moral and social characteristics. And so I think that's a really dangerous, slippery slope to go down. So those to me, and there are many other things that I have a problem with, the hostility towards freedom of speech and discussion, the way in which we accept America's very particular issues around police brutality and slavery as our own, even though they're related, they're definitely it's fundamentally different. So those are some of the issues that I think the contemporary narrative deeply, deeply gets wrong.
Mm. And what I always like to kind of bring different points kind of at their strongest into conversation with each other. And I'm kind of thinking through what do you think that movement gets right? And I am thinking wondering in particular about the kind of long tail of unjust structures, because I know from reading your work that it's not that you don't think racism exists at all, or that you think, you know, slavery and colonialism were broadly, well, slavery very much a bad thing, colonialism many harms, but that one of the things that's come out of the movement, I think, is how long it can take, both just within individuals whose ancestors experienced really significant trauma through kind of epigenetic transfer, that those experiences do change us over generations, but we're not quite sure how, and, you know, question mark. But also in terms of the way wealth is passed down, that is it possible that one of the things that this moment is doing is making more visible the long tail of some of those situations? And is it that you would kind of dispute all that, or that you would say, yes, I can see that, but it's not actually helpful for people of color to focus on it, because you want to work out what's helpful and hopeful in this moment?
Yeah, no, I think it's a bit of both. So I would challenge so many of the assumptions that of the contemporary discussion about race and racism. This kind of, particularly this idea that it's really, yes, 2020, the Black Lives Matter protests were a defining moment, but not for the reasons that I think is discussed oftentimes. It's you know, framed as the almost the first time, not exactly, but oftentimes almost the first time that we've had a kind of racial awakening, which I think, you know, would surprise many of the people in the many people that I know who were at the forefront of anti-racist protests, you know, during the 80s. There's actually been very long discussions that have happened about colonialism, about the way that we teach the British Empire. You know, I was taught about the British Empire in school, and actually history, for example, is not a compulsory subject anyway. So whether kids are getting history lessons is up for debate, let alone talking specifically or learning specifically about the British Empire. So I think a lot of the discussions that are being had don't actually stack up to the reality about the kinds of conversations and the kinds of policies that have been implemented over the last few decades in order to improve racial equality. You know, the Equality Act and various other anti-discrimination legislation have existed in this country for a very long time. It is illegal to discriminate against somebody on the grounds of race. Actually, the history curriculum is very diverse. You know, you do learn about many of the rights and the wrongs of British history. And actually, even the history of ethnic minority people in Britain is very heterogeneous. So many of the immigrants that are Black in the mid-20th century in the UK were of Caribbean heritage primarily. But now the majority of people that are Black Britons are children of people that actually came from waves of immigration much later, West African immigrants in the 80s and 90s. And so many of their history is not necessarily tied to the transatlantic slave trade in the same way that you might find for African Americans or Caribbean Americans. And actually, for example, Caribbean people, they're more likely, Caribbean men, for example, are more likely to marry a white woman than they are a Caribbean woman. So actually there's a lot of mixing and integration and relationships that are happening. And so the kind of picture that is broadly painted, I wouldn't actually say is accurate about the way that society is and the extent to which we have been interested in discussions about racism. So I don't really think it is true. And I think actually a lot of the time when these discussions are had about problems in Britain, I think that, you know, I do worry, and I think it is a difficult argument to make, but I do think that there is a danger in kind of cultivating a sense of a kind of black identity that is placed in opposition to society, and one that is almost hypersensitive to racism, or hypersensitive to slights and disagreements and perceiving them as racism. Because the truth of the matter is, I don't think most people in society think about people that much. I don't think people think about other races in that way. So I would question some of the assumptions, as well as argue that it's not helpful to cultivating, you know, hope and citizenship and mutual understanding.
It fascinated me to hear in another interview your kind of love of existentialist philosophers. And I don't know if that's still kind of live for you, but I'm always really interested in the kind of intellectual archaeology of people and, you know, what are our influences? Could you say a little bit more about what you're drawn to in Sartre and Camus and Nietzsche? What are the ideas that spark for you? Or if you've changed your mind, what happened?
Yeah, so I think it was a few years ago in particular, you know, going off of that same idea that I talked about earlier about kind of personal responsibility and human agency, and also the sense that one came from a broken home, I think I found a lot of meaning and clarity in the idea that we are ultimately responsible for where we are in life and what we do. And actually it relates very much actually to the discussion about race for me, that we overstate other constraining factors. And because we're fearful oftentimes, or are scared of the idea that we are actually free, that we can orient ourselves in the world and kind of create our world. And so to me, that made a lot of sense to me at a very particular time in my life, when I think that there was a lot of prevailing narratives about, you know, human fragility and human vulnerability and harm, and the kind of way in which particularly perceived marginalized groups were kind of did not have freedom. And I think it was, and you know, the Equiano Project is named after Alauda Equiano, who's an 18th century writer and abolitionist. And to me, it was his story really drew me, because even somebody that experienced slavery, which really is one of the ultimate forms of subjection and subjugation, was able to recognize his intrinsic dignity and humanity and challenge and transform his circumstances by buying his own freedom and actually using his voice in order to argue against the wicked practice of the slave trade. Now, of course, not everybody can do those things, and not every slave had the ability to do that. But I was always drawn by people like him or Frederick Douglass, who, even despite every message within society saying to you that you are effectively nothing, that you're worthless, you're no more than a slave, to be able to believe in freedom and freedom of speech as he did, to me says something remarkably profound about human consciousness or the human, and therefore existentialism, which along those same lines talks about the fact human responsibility and our human freedom, was very resonated with me very strongly at that time. And so, I mean, now I don't read as much existentialist work as I did several years ago.
Most people don't after they graduate.
Yeah, that's probably true. So I don't read as much now, but if at all. But at that time, it was very meaningful to me. And I don't know if it's just getting older. I don't know. But I am increasingly, whilst freedom and freedom of speech and all of those things were a big motivating factor for my political activism, I am increasingly interested in the things that constrain freedom, like morality. And it's something I'm still working through, I'm still thinking about. And actually, I've not been as vocal in public life in recent months because I'm thinking through a lot of ideas. But questions around sexual morality, questions about are there things that are more important than freedom, such as relationships of mutual obligation, such as duty, such as honor, such as family values, and I haven't come to a definitive conclusion, but I think that there is a danger of creating a society where freedom effectively becomes license. Where it becomes a kind of shallow self creating, you know, your own moral values that is detached from society and detached from social relations and a kind of hollow self actualization that is without roots. And I think that there's a lot of issues in our society, you know, around gender, around the questions that we've just discussed. And I think a lot of people say, well, you know, is my freedom to do so? And I think, yes, perhaps it is your freedom, but is that right? Is that good? And how do we talk about, and can we even talk about in a kind of secular, liberal modern society, a notion of what is good? And how do we transmit a notion of the good collectively rather than it just being everybody inventing their own idea of the good? So that's kind of where I'm at, and I'm still working through that. But I'm increasingly interested in the relationship between freedom and actually what's good and what is right.
It sounds like you are feeling the pull of post-liberalism.
Maybe.
And I think Anna, there's dignity and honour in it, right? Starting with freedom as a sacred value, you know, as a really fundamental baseline for things. And then as we come to see that kind of free individuals are a bit of a fiction and we are irreconcilably interdependent and we do owe things to each other, kind of that nuancing of freedom as the kind of ultimate end is it's a good and important.
I agree. And I think, and maybe that is just, you know, in your youth, in a way, you know, I love the idea of young people, you know, experimenting and exploring and feeling and pursuing, you know, a sense of freedom. And maybe it is just that natural arc that actually, you know, as you gain responsibility, as you gain a stake within society, you know, as you learn some lessons the hard way, that you start to question that, and you start to want to mitigate against the sharp end of things, and you want to protect the things that you value, that you've created. And so yeah, I'm not too worried about the arc, but maybe I am slowly going on that direction.
Maybe I can talk to you again in 5 years. Inaya Falaran Iman, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you.
So, Inaya, I wonder if you had the same reaction to me when you heard her biography. Brexit Party spiked GB News. If you're outside the UK, you might not know that particularly GB News and Spiked are media outlets that are seen as being are quite new. Spiked has gone back a while, actually, but are GB News was explicitly set up to provide a kind of Fox News for the UK. And Spiked News, it's hard to sort of peg it politically, really, but it's sort of self-consciously controversial. Very much, you know, whatever it seems like the consensus is, Spiked will commission a piece with someone arguing the exact opposite. And so these things on Inaya's CV made me expect someone much, much, just much more, much scrappier, you know, much more of a culture warrior, really, than the woman that I met. I was expecting someone much more adversarial, maybe less nuanced than came across. And this project repeatedly forces me to notice and then move past my prejudices, because, as you will have heard, Inaya is, as we all are, just much more three-dimensional than any box we could put anybody in. And so her sacred valley was home. You know, she had this beautiful sense of wanting to put down roots, of having moved a lot as a child and then being drawn to put down roots. And so central in her story is this figure of her mum, this, what she calls a kind of, you know, self-confident woman who brought up children on her own, who left her faith community when it felt like it wasn't a fit for her anymore. And you can really hear that kind of powerful self-confidence, I guess, and self-belief passed down to the daughter. It's always a lovely thing when you can hear the roots of the parenting that's created someone. And Inaya also talked about something that's come up with other people about a kind of working class conservatism. And people from immigrant communities often complicate the narrative of who sits on the left and who sits on the right, and what people of colour can be expected to believe or align politically. I think it's never been as simple as it's sometimes made out to be, and it certainly will only get more complex. But yeah, this sense of personal responsibility, duty, moral obligation to make good use of your life. It came through with Catherine Birbal Singh as well, although she's moved to that position. I love this picture of Inaya watching The Big Questions on television as a sort of beautifully nerdy teenager, desperate to get involved in The Big Questions, in these ideas of how do we live together? What is a good life? What should politics look like? And I really felt the, you know, she talks about it very calmly, but maybe I was imagining or projecting how difficult it must be to be at university and be coming to different conclusions to your peers about how to navigate questions of race, about how to act or speak as a Black woman. And often when we're thinking about divides and tribes, this thing comes up again that it's sometimes when you move tribes or you reveal yourself to be to hold a position or not be part of a tribe that people expect you to be in, or hold a view that people expect you to hold, how difficult that can be relationally. Paul Kingsnorth talked about it with vaccines. It's come up around race. It's come up around a lot of things, actually. Changing your views on sexuality, you know, changing your religion. And it's this sort of sad thing, isn't it, that we should be able to be in deep relationships of loving friendship with people who really, really disagree on things with us. But in practice, that can really press on something quite deep. And we know that if we don't, if we aren't intentional about it, our friendship groups can end up being all people like us, socioeconomically, politically, religiously. It speaks to this thing that I think about a lot, about a sort of unstable self, a self that is always looking out to the world and to those around us to say, who am I? And when someone around us changes, we can feel very destabilized. And it is really a challenge to me and a call to me to let my friends change tribes, to let my friends change political beliefs, to let them hold beliefs or values that are directly opposite to what I do, and still love them, because that should be possible. And it is the only way I think we stay open to the world, open-hearted, open-minded in any real way. It's really interesting listening to her perspective on where we are with the race conversation, and this sense that comes through of wanting to have a both and. I think that's what I'm hearing from her. To both be able to say, you know, yes, people of colour still have many more hurdles to clear than white people. There is still racism to navigate, and there are far fewer hurdles and far less racism to navigate than there used to be. To kind of be able to celebrate where we've come from, and not, and in that to maintain a sense of optimism, I think. I hear from her a sense of progress, a sense that actually we can live together better with our differences. We can move forward, we can build trust, and that something about the way we're talking about it at the moment is making that more difficult. And I really heard from her this sense that it might just be temperamental, of wanting a sense of agency herself. And she used this phrase, coming from a broken home, which I haven't heard anyone use in a while, really, and particularly not someone, you know, use it about themselves, but it relates to her, you know, love of existentialism, this sense of agency building. You know, I don't want to tell a story about myself that I'm crushed under the system of, you know, of a racist society. I want to have agency. I want to be able to make my own way in the world. And connected to that, we didn't get into it in depth, but is this a sense of universalism, the sense of wanting to focus on what we have in common rather than the ways that are different. It was really thought-provoking, and I'm going to be sitting with it for a while. And then we landed at the end, and it's always really, I love getting to talk to people at all different life stages, you know, in their 20s like Anaya, and in their 60s and 70s, and the journey that they've gone on, and the way we change over time. You know, we think something strongly, we believe something strongly, and the freedom to change our minds, to feel our way, to lift and listen to different people seems really important to me. And you can just hear her doing that. You know, freedom has been such a strong value to her. And now she's beginning to be interested in, you know, what might limit freedom, what might a kind of morality, in her words, where should that be allowed to limit it? And I really genuinely am interested in where Anaya's thought goes next. Thank you so much for listening to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and our production team are Lizzie Harvey, Dan Turner, and we are edited by Drew Hawley. Our music is by Luke Stanley, with vocals from Lizzie Harvey, and we are a project of the think tank Theos. As always, please, please, please think about leaving us a rating. It takes one click, or a review. It takes a few more clicks, but I will read them and rejoice. Even, I think, if they're challenging, because I want to hear what you think. Maybe send an episode to a friend talk about us on social media. The podcast is currently free and has no advertising, and we would really value your support in this way. Until next time.